Melody's up next with Truth Quest, and she's going to start you off with a tune from the Dixie Chicks.
This is Truth Quest with Melody and Eric Carlstrom as my co-host. And tonight we've got Barry Tomich, a great journalist that's from Israel that's going to fill us in on a whole lot of interesting he's going to be a very interesting guest, let's put it this way. And while I'm at it, I do want to say that the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHN, its staff, or board of directors. And this is KAGNLP 106.9 Salida. Hello, Barry.
Hi.
I need to get your level picked up here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. All right. And with the and with Eric. I want to say hi, Eric. And
yes, hello, Melody, and welcome, Barry.
There we go.
Thank you. It's nice to hear your voice, but just so you know, you're kind of in a deep cavern.
Yeah, It needs to be taken up a little bit louder.
Okay, for me, is that any better? Does that still sound like it's in a cavern?
Well, so are we on the air?
Yes, we are.
Oh, my goodness. We should be talking about this on the air. I can hear you. Okay.
Well, I need to hear Barry better, so if you can turn him up.
Okay. There we go. Okay. One of the first questions I wanted to ask, since you're... first I'll let you describe, you know, your background for the audience, and then we can go in with some questions that we've got for you.
Well, I'm not good at describing my own background, but let it be said that in Israel I'm very well known. I had a best-selling novel. It wasn't a novel, it was a book. It was called Humor to Yitzhak Rabin. And in case your listeners don't know me, it was not the kid sitting in jail, Yigal Amir. It was a high-level political coup, and I proved it. And by the way, the book made number 3 on the Yediot Ahronot bestseller charts, and I think it's the same thing in Haaretz. It was one of the bestsellers of the last decade, so it's not a conspiracy book as such. It's quite mainstream. And the book claims that the person sitting in prison for the murder didn't do it, but didn't just claim it. It proved it pretty thoroughly. I was working off 2,500 documents that I shouldn't have had, but I made a big stink there, and the stink got me well enough known that I was given the evidence. And this is, what made me very well known in Israel. Now, what I did with that is I went looking for who actually murdered Rabin, and hold on one sec, please, with the water, please. And what happened is that it was a very nasty little search. But ultimately, the murder was Shimon Peres. He was the one who organized the murder of Rabin. The plot itself, Peres gave the order. It was given to the head of our secret services, the Shabak, Carmi Gilon. And Carmi Gilon assigned a bodyguard to Rabin. His name was Yoram Rubin. And it was Rubin who pulled the trigger. It was Rubin who actually shot Rabin. But it gets worse than that. We'll now talk about one of many murders that the current president of Israel was involved with, and the next one was Sharon. And Sharon is not murdered. I mean, he's sitting in hospital waiting for a brain transplant. If anyone knows a good brain, he's waiting for one. But Sharon was on December 18th of the year 2005. He had a key with Shimon Peres in the Knesset. And half an hour later, he felt bad, and he was taken to a hospital with a stroke by Yoram Rubin, the murderer of Yitzhak Rabin. So we know it was Peres and his murder gang operating to get rid of Sharon and gain power. And it was at this point where I got to trouble. I didn't want to start. I didn't have the energy left to investigate another political assassination in Israel. Rabin had just about sucked me dry. I had fought for over a decade to get the truth out. And, with success. Every poll taken in Israel in the last 5 years has shown that the majority of Jews in that country, forget Arabs, they don't know anything, but the Jews do, show that the majority of Jews support my thesis of the a political coup led by Shimon Peres more than the government's lying official story of the assassination. And this is going on to this day where the majority of Israeli Jews know that I was right. And after my book, there were seven other books reaching the exact same conclusions that I reached, using the evidence that, well, I had gathered at least half of it. Other researchers have contributed and helped, but, well, the fact of the matter is I had a certain public charisma, and I looked good on camera, and just certain things that, well, I had the first book. Certain things that put me at the top of the Rabin assassination truth quest. I wrote the book that inspired half the Israeli public. And by the way, I gave at least 400 lectures in Israel, 398 of them in Hebrew. So I went out to the Israeli people and I showed them the facts. And I had a great lecture. I still do, by the way. Anyone can invite me, and I'll be more than happy to give you a lecture in criminology.
You also might plug your website.
My website has drifted away from Rabin and has gone into the broader picture. But if you go through the archives, you'll find my Rabin research as well. Look, anyone
wants to write me.
I have the Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin book. You just write Chamish at netvision.net.il. That's Chamish, Chamish, at netvision, one long word, netvision.net.il. And you can, I'll send you a copy of the book, and it won't cost you much. Well, for now, the point is that book was a major bestseller in Israel, and I became very well known. I mean, I would take a suitcase full of my books to events and rallies. Wherever there were potential buyers, I would sell the suitcase. Crowds would gather around me. Autographs would be taken. People would take pictures beside the famous Barry Chambers. From the point of view of gaining a tremendous amount of celebrity status, the murder of Rabin did it for me. It was really a very successful enterprise, but we're now going to pop forward to Sharon's murder, where I guess the bad guys, led by our president, Shimon Yichzev Peres, that would be his initials, I guess. It would be Shimon PDY for Fui Yich, and whatever else. I mean, he's a murderer. The man to gain power, and it's not power for Israel or for the Jews. It's power to destroy Israel, and this is finally recognized. Nonetheless, he murders people, but after the Sharon stroke, which again was a murder, and it was again Peres and Yoram Rubin who murdered Sharon. After this, I guess somebody said, we don't want Chalmers investigating this one, because as Sharon went to the hospital for a cerebral hemorrhage on January the 4th, and I reported the doctors in Hadassah Hospital admitted that they killed Sharon. They went on TV, the whole gang of them, and said, we gave him the wrong medicine, we killed him. And if you want later on, I can dive into that story as well. But nonetheless, then suddenly I got a stroke. Right after Sharon gets a killing stroke, I get a stroke. And believe me, I'm too young to have a stroke.
So this kind of investigative reporting that you've been doing can be very hazardous to your health, I guess. Is that
well, it wasn't for the longest time, but they are really... well, by the way, it's not just Israel. I mean, look at your own government. It's the same animal going on here.
There's a parallel between what's going on in Israel and in the American situation and leadership.
No. Don't jump too far ahead here. What they're talking about the Middle East is a plot and a plan where Israel gets wiped out and decimated, and it's America against Israel. So I wouldn't jump that far ahead quite yet. But what you've got in Iraq, there were two soldiers in August. August, 3 weeks ago. Who signed an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying that the Iraq war was an atrocity and we had to get out. They died right after that. There was an accident with their truck, and they were the only two people to die in that accident. There were seven people in the truck. Only the two sergeants who signed the New York Times op-ed died. And again, Pat Tillman, who was made into this massive hero because he played for the Arizona Cardinals and gave it all up to volunteer and fight in Afghanistan, he was shot through the head from 10 feet distance. Two shots were with him on the ground. He was fragged by his own men. And if you open your mouth in a public way against the war in Iraq, your government will kill you, and this should be understood. It's the same danger from that point of view as it is in Israel. In Israel, they have been killing what you call the settlers, I call the residents of Judea and Samaria. They've been killing their rabbis, and they've been killing their political leaders, and this is a matter of policy. And we could go into that because I'm not just giving you an opinion. I'm giving you documents that I've seen, and I'll tell you where I saw them. But let's stick with, first of all, the general picture. It's extremely dangerous to expose the... well, look, there are a lot of words that have been used to describe the American government and the Israeli government. The point is the expression used most often... the New World Order establishment that's taken over the United States. The New World Order apparently was taken from a speech George Bush Sr. Gave on the eve of the Persian Gulf War, that there will be a New World Order because of this war. And they're using that to describe the leadership of the United States. The key of the matter, I'm not sure that, by the way, I use that as well because everyone else uses it, and why use an expression that no one's ever heard of that you've made up when this becomes so commonplace. But the issue remains the same, is that the rulers of the United States are not the people, the American people, any more than the rulers of Israel or the Israeli people. Now, the diplomatic headquarters of the American government, and many people know this, many people don't, but it's a think tank in Manhattan called the Council on Foreign Relations. And unless you realize that, well, everyone, Cheney, Rice, Powell, it doesn't matter, all of them, every Secretary of State since Eisenhower's time has come from the CFR, every National Security Advisor. This is not just an organization. It determines who will run for president, and it determines the policy of the United States. Now, John Kerry, by the way, is a very, very small think tank. It's only got 4,200 members, that's all. But John Kerry, of course, the opponent in the last election, was a member of the CFR, and Dick Cheney, the vice president, is a member of the CFR, and Samuel Bush, not Prescott Bush, the son, who was the leading figure, American figure supporting Adolf Hitler financially through the Harriman Brothers Boston. It was his father, Samuel, was the founder of the Council on Foreign Relations, and this is the actual diplomatic headquarters of the organization that is ruling the United States as well. But in Israel, and I'm trying to keep this logical or else we're going to get lost and the story is actually logical. Once you get the hang of it, you can predict tomorrow's news just by watching the news today. The key is the two forces that are now going to destroy Israel. Israel probably won't survive another year. You'll probably see the end of Israel starting this November at a conference organized by Bush in Washington, where Israel is going to show up with its hands in the air and its leadership giving up the country, dividing Jerusalem, cleaning out Judea and Samaria in the same inhumane fashion that they cleaned up the Jews of the Gaza Strip. Probably within a year, there'll be no more Israel. The two organizations who are now controlling Israel and its leadership and leading the people to extinction, and another Holocaust, by the way. We'll get to that shortly, I guess. We have 2 hours. We can get to anything. Nevertheless, they are the Council on Foreign Relations and the Vatican. Shimon Peres is simply a spy for the Vatican, and he has been for a long, long time. And Olmert is a crook. They're all mafia crooks. The Israeli government is simply the mafia. They're all a combination of thieves, embezzlers, pedophiles, and murderers. We should not forget the murderers. Ehud Barak, Minister of Defense, is a murderer, and we'll go through that as well. But first let me lay out the basic trouble. The Vatican and the Council on Foreign Relations are arranging the end of Israel. It's that simple. Israel should not survive this year, and it probably won't.
Can you explain why, Barry, you think that they are arranging the end of Israel?
Yes.
This is actually new probably to me and to probably most of the listeners here.
What's new? Israel's surrounded now by 70,000 missiles. Look, you've got, let's start with the north. You've got Hezbollah. Israel lost a war last year to Hezbollah. Hezbollah had about 1,000 fighters, just a ragtag bunch of terrorists who defeated Israel. Now, they, in 34 days, launched 4,000 rockets. And they killed, about 120 people. All of northern Israel was cleaned out. Haifa was empty. Everyone who had a car was sleeping on the beaches for a month. They were in Jerusalem. They were in Tel Aviv, but they were not the Haifa. The whole north. It was Haifa, it was Tiberias, it was Tzfat, it was Nahariya, Metula. All of northern Israel was abandoned. And that's 2 million people, a third of the population of Israel, either slept in shelters or headed to the center of the country away from the rockets. Now, if you think 4,000 missiles shot over 34 days can wreck Israel, and by the way, Israel was wrecked last summer, wrecked. Well, wait till you see when 10,000 missiles hit Tel Aviv on the first day of the upcoming war, and Tel Aviv is turned into rubble. And the only human activity will be children looking for their parents buried under the rubble, parents looking for their children buried under the rubble. No ambulance will get through. The roads will be pocked. There'll be no police. There'll be no army. Within 1 day of the next war, the Arabs are going to knock out Tel Aviv. Now, Hezbollah has about 20,000 missiles, maybe more, and they're deep underground, by the way. They're 180 yards under the ground, so the Israeli Air Force can't touch them. They'll come out, they'll shoot, and they'll go back underground. These are deep bunkers. Now, you've got Hamas, which is in an area that Israel abandoned, the Gaza Strip, Gush Katif. It was an atrocity that Israel abandoned its most prosperous citizens, who were producing 25% of Israeli agricultural produce. Literally, the whole flour market came out of Gaza. This was the success story of modern Zionism with the Gaza Strip, the Israeli government using its army, clean these people out. Now wait till you see what happens with Hamas when the war starts. They've shot 2,000 missiles from old Gush Katif. 2,000 missiles at Sderot, a city that once had 24,000 Jews. It's now, anyone who can get out there is out of there. There are about 10,000 people left who can't afford to live anywhere else. They're living in utter daily terror. This all from Gush Katif. This was when we used to have an army in the Gaza Strip, and the army was reduced and removed, and of course Israel is paying the price. Ashkelon will be next. Ashkelon has not been hit as hard as Sderot. It will be. And of course, Egypt is at war with Israel. And this is something the Israelis are hushing up in the biggest way, is that the damn Camp David Accord of 1977, it was signed in 79, where Egypt, Sadat and Begin, they hug and they kiss, and this lunkhead Jimmy Carter of the Council on Foreign Relations, by the way, like Bill Clinton of the Council on Foreign Relations, well, he put together a peace treaty that's dead. Egypt is using the Sinai Peninsula as a transfer territory to make sure Hamas gets all the materials necessary to build, first of all, its primitive rockets, but it's got medium-range rockets, and we'll find out about when the war starts.
Well, can you...
I haven't finished. What do you mean, can I?
Well,
let
me just add something. It's pretty well known over here that the United States government has been subsidizing the state of Israel to the tune of somewhere between $3 and $5 billion.
Israel doesn't need a dime of it. Let me finish, please. Next, you have Saudi Arabia, which has signed an agreement with Syria 4 months ago. It will use its missiles not only against the resort town of Eilat. There are two major air force bases north of Eilat. They will be pockmarked with missiles from Saudi Arabia. Next, you have the PLO. Now, we know that they have got a lot of missiles because they held a parade. And they held this parade in February where they proudly announced that not only are they building missiles, they have an artillery factory in Ramallah, which, of course, Israel is allowing to build all the artillery necessary to bomb Tel Aviv. But then things get very serious. You have Syria, which has 40,000 missiles, many, many of them with biological and chemical warheads. And, of course, you have Iran far away, which claims that if Israel attacks Syria, it will bomb 600 major Israeli sites immediately from Iran. Israel will be faced with 60 to 70,000 missiles. Tel Aviv will be hit on the first day. And with Tel Aviv goes the IDF Intelligence Command, which is in Ramat Gan. And now, as I said, 4,000 missiles knocked out northern Israel last summer, over 34 days. Try and imagine 10,000 in one day aimed at the country's largest city, and then you have the next war, which Israel will literally lose within a day or two. Now, after the second day, Syria will come in and will knock up the electricity and will knock up the communications, and when that happens, there's no more Israeli defense forces. It's gone. It's finished. The Israeli defense forces rely on electricity and telephone lines and communications. Without that, every unit is on its own, and simple anti-tank weapons, RPGs, can knock out tanks because there's no helicopters, there's no airplanes, there's no artillery. Nothing is working in coordination, and then Israel will be taken apart piece by piece. When that happens, by the way, the simple Arab, not just their armies, you're going to get Arabs who are going to go for the easiest settlements. and they're going to overpower this easiest settlements because the weaponry has been taken away from the settlements. This is something you may or may not know, but Israel, and I'll go into it. But the fact of the matter is the weaponry is gone. So what will happen is the Arabs will take over the settlements, and the first thing they'll do is they'll shoot up the men trying to defend the place, but the ones that survive, they'll gather them together, and they'll get their wives and children, and they'll make the husbands wash as they rape their wives, as they split the throats of their children, and then when they've seen enough, they'll shoot them. You'll have a Holocaust going. You'll probably see, well, in 1 week, as little as a week, 10 days, you'll see 5.5 million Israeli Jews murdered in a Holocaust by the Arabs. And by the way, they hate the Jews every bit as much as the Nazis ever hated them. They've been waiting for this moment, and the Israeli government will hand it to them. Probably within this year, you'll see Israel disappear in a first-class Holocaust. That's the basic outline. Now, if you want to go through details, I'll go through details.
Well, let me just add a couple things. From this side, there's been a lot of information coming around on the Internet how three entire fleets of American naval battleships are now off the coast of Iran. Our government is saber-rattling to possibly use bunker buster nukes in Iran. They say we're not going to take anything off the table. So there is quite a bit of a concern on the part of many Americans that our government may do a preemptive strike against Iran.
Well, preemptive means that Iran is about to do something and you're preempting them. What are they about to do?
Well, exactly. These are the statecraft terms. Of course, the pretext is on false charges that they're about to come up with a nuclear weapon, which the CIA says is at least 10 years away.
Well, how come Iranian atomic officials can't come to America and inspect your facilities?
Yeah, of course. but, you know, it's pretty well known that Israel, on the other hand, does have perhaps 200 nuclear weapons.
Probably more, but it doesn't matter. We'll use them. Remember, this is an Israeli government that's going to let Israel kill itself. Last summer, Haifa, the third largest city, a city of 500,000 people, was abandoned, and that is a pretext. Supposedly, the Israeli government has always hinted that if that ever happened, they would saber rattle with their own nuclear weapons. That didn't happen, and it's not going to happen, by the way. Israel, I'm trying to explain a concept that seems to be lost on people. The Israeli government is not working for the Jewish people, and it never did. Israel was not founded to be a shelter for the Jews ever. And this is a concept, it's more than a concept. Labor Zionism despises religious Jews. Now, I'm going to do a very complicated concept in a very short period, but if you don't understand this, you don't understand that the leaders of Israel will destroy the country, and they could care less how many Jews survive or don't. There was a false messiah of the Jews named Shabtai Tzvi. On June 18th of 1666, he declared himself the messiah of the Jews, and I assure you, the Vatican spread the word, because half the world's Jewry, I've read figures as much as three-quarters, and every book says from Iran to Mexico, that's the famous quote in every book, believed that he was the new Messiah. And they threw away their possessions and sold their house for a penny on the dollar, climbed mountains, and expected to be transported to Jerusalem. It didn't happen. And eventually, most Jews abandoned Shabtai Tzvi because the Sultan of Turkey forced them to convert to Islam, but it wasn't all Jews. There was a cult in Turkey called the Donda. The Donda decided that there was a secret message from Shabtai Tzvi that we should also convert to other faiths. In their case, it would be Islam. Later on, we will get to the Catholic Church, but they preserved this concept that Shabtai Tzvi was the true Messiah of the Jews. Now, Shabtai Tzvi's philosophy was very simple. the Torah is wrong. Every word that is wrong and the opposite is true. So in other words, at an extreme level, do not kill becomes do kill. And believe me, when the Holocaust took place with the labor Zionists working hand-to-hand with the Nazis, and we'll go into the transfer agreement and how Israel was actually formed, that concept was in full blossom. Now, there's a wonderful writer who has inspired me, and that's Rabbi Marvin Antleman. He wrote a book on the Sabbateans, published in 1974. It was also the first expose of the Council on Foreign Relations written by a legitimate Jewish source. He said just outright the Holocaust was a burnt offering of the labor Zionists who were the Sabbateans who founded Israel. Israel was founded by the murderers of Jews. And this is a tough one for people to understand, but I'm going to add one thing. 70 years later, the second Messiah was born. His name was Jacob Frank. He lived in Poland and was busy converting Polish Jews to Catholicism, where they would become spies. And that's exactly what he had. He had a spy agency. But somehow he ran out of money. And that money somehow, all the history books say the same thing, that he moved his headquarters to Frankfurt, Germany. And in 1787, he became unexpectedly wealthy. Well, I did the reading, and I figured out what happened in 1787. He had a meeting in Frankfurt, Germany, at the home of Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who was, by the way, he was no big shot then. He had five very ambitious sons, but he was basically a coin trader. He wanted to get really rich, and he came up, his sons, whoever came up with this, said if we could control the economies of the world, we could control the money of the world. And he had a meeting with Jacob Frank of the Sabbateans, and here is the final party of that meeting. Adam Weishaupt, founder of the Illuminati. Now, those who don't know what the Illuminati is, it's not for me right now probably to dive into it, but it was founded by the Jesuit faction of the Vatican. Its sole purpose was to a war against the Protestant Reformation. This was what it was all about, destroy the foundations of anyone who betrayed the Pope and became anti-Rome. Destroy their societies. Destroy what keeps the societies going. Their family structure, their royalty, their religion. Anything that keeps the society together, the Illuminati attacked. And now you've got, really, after this meeting, you've got the conspiracy that has wrecked the world for the last 230 years, has actually ruined the world. You've got, and here is the triangle that is at work today in Iraq. It's at work in Afghanistan. It's at work in Israel. My Lord, it's at work in Israel. They are, one, the Illuminati. That is the Council on Foreign Relations, part of the Council on Foreign Relations. And we will go into why, for instance, you've got 40 million illegal Mexicans in the country. It's to turn American Catholic. It's to change your voting structure. And people don't understand that this is a deliberate policy, and it's only one example of many. Next, you've got, and here is the group people don't know about, and they've got to, the Sabbateans. The Sabbateans, they have a war against Judaism. Anyone who believes the Torah is their enemy, and anyone who doesn't accept Shabbat Tzvi, Jacob Frank, as the Messiah of the Jews, is their enemy. And these people work hand-in-hand with the Vatican, using Rothschild money to ruin the Jewish people. I mean, the Jewish people are ruined. Before these people came along, there wasn't Jewish self-hatred. There wasn't a reform movement. They invented it. There wasn't a conservative movement. They invented it. There was what just simply Judaism. It wasn't divided. Right now, the whole world's got maybe 12 million Jews. We should have 80 million Jews. And there are reasons why we don't, but the Sabbateans got rid of the Jews through assimilation, through pogroms, through the Holocaust, of course. Now, the Holocaust is not an easy story, but keep one thing in mind. The Sabbateans could not convince the Jews to change their religion. They could not convince the Jews that they ever had a Messiah named Shabbat Zvi or Jacob Frank. So what they decided in the 1860s is that they could convince the Jews if they got Israel back and they turned it into a Sabbatean state. And this is what's going on in Israel today, except it didn't turn into a Sabbatean state. The religious Jews won. They won the battle. They don't want labor Zionism anymore. But the story of leading to Israel is a vicious and nasty story. I'm going to maybe return to this, but I'm going to give one little example of how off one little piece of history, and that was a meeting in 1896 in Jerusalem. The leader of Germany, Count Wilhelm, went all the way to Jerusalem to consecrate three churches. And by the way, in 1896, nobody went to Jerusalem for a holiday. There were no roads. There were no hotels. It was filled with bandits. It was not a place you went to, certainly not the leader of the largest country in Europe. He went there and he consecrated three churches. The big one, of course, was the Dormition Abbey on Mount Zion, overlooking the whole city. This he got permission from the Turks to do. But there's something nobody seems to understand, and that is that the leader of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, followed him to Jerusalem. Now, in 1896, the father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, meets the ruler of the largest country in Europe on November 2nd, of 1896, and all the history books will tell us is that Herzl was rebuffed by Wilhelm. Now, what does rebuffed mean? Rebuffed means that, well, the only reason Herzl could have been in Jerusalem was to get himself a country. And the only way that the Germans could get Herzl a country was to go to war against Turkey and win it for them. And obviously, Germany said no. Germany said, we are now allied with the Turks. You're not getting your country through us. And Herzl went back to England, and he had an amazing, amazing change of heart. We know this, that he met the major Zionists of England, including Lord Balfour and Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann was the worst butcher the Jews had ever known. He was an absolute butcher of millions of Jews. He ended up Israel's first president. Herzl told the British that we cannot have a state in Palestine. You cannot fight the German-Turkish alliance to get a state. Too many people will die. Well, the first person to die was Theodor Herzl. Now, Jewish history will tell you that Herzl worked so hard that one day his heart stopped. I went looking through the history of Theodor Herzl. That's not what happened at all. One day in 1905, age 44, he went into a sanatorium in Paris where he died of a disease not fully understood or known. That's what happened to Herzl. He was assassinated. He was assassinated because he no longer supported a state in Palestine. He did not want Eretz Israel, which was the focal point of the Sabbatean Jews. And for that he died. That was the first Zionist assassination. And now let's keep something hugely in mind. There was a very good Zionism. There was a Zionism trying to stop the Holocaust. It was called revisionist Zionism. It was led by Vladimir Jabotinsky, Zev Jabotinsky. He knew what the Sabbateans were doing. He knew that the word was out that if you took a boat and tried to get out of Germany, because there was an agreement called the transfer agreement, And in that agreement, the labor Zionists promised the Nazis if they made life so miserable for the Jews that they had nowhere to go but Palestine, and they gave them the seed population for a new Israel, a new Judaism, they would buy only German goods. They would stop worldwide boycotts of Nazism. They would support the Nazis in every way they could. They would not mention what you were doing in Europe, even if you killed every European religious Jew alive, just get us the Jews. And the worldwide diplomatic word was any Jew who gets on a boat, you don't let him in. You don't let him in Cuba or Panama or Halifax or America. Anyone who refuses to go to Palestine gets sent back to Europe and most likely his death and demise. This was done with the Jewish agency in Jerusalem. They had no sympathy for any Jew who went anywhere but Palestine. Between 1933 and 1939, they got their 80,000 Jews from Germany. Then the British closed the borders of Palestine. It was all over, and that was it. That was the deal. They got the seed stock for the new Judaism, the Sabbatean Judaism. And this, in 1933, the good Zionists, the Zionists that Israelis want, the revisionist Zionists, the Zionists of Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir and everyone they want to vote for, this Zionism was thrown out of the Jewish agency. It had absolutely no influence anymore. The Zionism of the Holocaust was the Zionism of labor Zionism. And these people wanted a Sabbatean state. And we can go through an awful lot of the atrocities getting that state. But they eventually got an Israel which they tried to turn into a secular, anti-Torah state. But unfortunately for them, the Jews would not give up. In Judea and Samaria, they created a marvelous Torah-loving state and a society that worked beautifully. And now they can't live with that. It's against everything they built Israel for. And that's why President Shimon Peres is working with the Vatican to destroy this Israel. It didn't turn out the way they wanted it to. They will destroy the country because it is not going to be a Sabbatean state. It's going to be a religious state. The Jews are going to use Israel to practice actual Judaism and not Sabbateanism. And they said to themselves, we failed. We tried our best. We didn't succeed. The state goes. There. That's my next section. You got any questions?
Yeah. This is very interesting. And, of course, quite a bit of it is new. To me, and I think most of our listeners, especially the part about the Sabbatean Jews, because I don't think many of
them...
They're
not Jews, they're Sabbateans.
Okay.
They're not born Jewish, they have Jewish blood in them, okay. But they have long converted.
And now, would they consider themselves to be Sabbateans?
Yeah, they sure do. Now, a lot of people don't. They consider themselves to be Israelis, and not Jews, Israelis. Now, after the election before the last, when Peres lost, he was asked a simple question. If you lost, who won? And he answered, if the Jews won, the Israelis lost. Israeli has become the term for Sabbatean. And it's a term that won't last much longer. But yeah, that's what they believe, that Israel was supposed to be a Sabbatean state, and instead it's becoming a Jewish state, and this they cannot tolerate.
This would be a worldwide religion, I guess, Sabbateanism.
Sabbateanism is a belief literally in Satanism.
Oh.
It's a belief that every true word of the Torah is wrong, and the opposite is true. That is Sabbateanism.
Okay. So we're talking about Satanism here.
We're not necessarily, you know what, you're talking in the highest reaches, I would say you're right about that. Now, I've got more than enough proof of Sabbateanism was built along a lot of pedophilia, a great deal of wife-swapping. Jewish holidays became wife-swapping holidays. Purim was a holiday where you swap wives. This was Sabbateanism, and this is what Israel was all the way through. If you read about what was going on in the kibbutzim, if you read about the lifestyle that was being promoted by the first Zionists, this is what they were doing, the labor Zionists. But on the other hand, there was this good Zionism that was trying to balance it, and in the end, the good Zionism won.
Okay.
Wait, I'm having some trouble hearing you. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay. Look, I'm going to give you some addresses, because if you don't know this, you really should read me. Now, I have most of my books on something called Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com.
Yes,
I publish it on the internet, and you can buy it very, very cheaply. $20, the book is sent to your house. $10 is downloaded onto your computer. Go to LULU.com. Now, the book you want in this case is Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. If you get that book, things will be a lot clearer to you. Now, there's one other book that you should look at. It's my new book. It's called Bye Bye Gaza. Bye Bye Gaza is how these Sabbateans infiltrated every organization defending the Israeli so-called settlers. I don't like that term. It should be residents of Judea and Samaria. At one point, of course, Gaza, but they got rid of them. They're rabbis. They're politicians. They're public figures. They were all working for the government. And this is, well, it's very frustrating for me personally when one after another they come out and admit that they were working with the police, the Aisha Council, the Council of the Communities of Judea and Samaria. Betsy Lieberman, their head, admitted at a trial last winter, I think it was in December, of Avigdor Lieberman, that he was working with the police to make sure that no protesters got to Gush Katif. The rabbi, Shlomo Avinair, was the one who set up this wacko protest where the youth of Israel handed out orange pieces of cloth as a protest. That's what they did. They spent a year handing out orange pieces of cloth and hugging soldiers. And Pinchas Wallerstein, second-in-command of the Aisha Council, has the youth of Aisha sleeping outside in Jerusalem in January in the middle of snowstorms to sap their energy. All of the people supporting, at least people that the settlers thought were supporting them, were working against them. Go get my book, Bye Bye Gaza. Go to lulu.com. Type my name in where it says search, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, Chamish, and you'll get that book. And this business I'm trying to tell you will be a lot clearer to you. Okay. I've written an awful lot because simply my point of view is so drastically different than the hacks writing for us, ready to defend Israel, the horrible hacks out there thinking they know what's going on and why Israel's going down the drain, and they don't. Because my point of view is so drastically different, I've written an awful lot of books in the last 12 years, I think 9 of them, and you'll find 8 of them up on this lulu.com.
Excellent. Barry, would you say that the Sabbatean influence is in the Council on Foreign Relations as well?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Now, remember what I told you, that the Sabbateans have a philosophy. We convert to their religion, but we secretly maintain our own religion at our own gatherings, but we pretend that we are other religions. Now, look what happens in the CFR. Almost every time, the CFR appoints someone to high office, some journalist looks into their background. And what do we discover? John Kerry's father's a Jew? Everyone thought John Kerry's father was Irish. Everyone. And worse, John Kerry doesn't know what his father is. Who doesn't know what their father is? Madeleine Albright of the Council on Foreign Relations. She doesn't know she's a Jew. Both her parents, all her cousins, her entire family is Jewish, and she didn't know she was a Jew. Wesley Clark is bombing Bosnia to shreds, and he discovers while he's bombing Bosnia that his father's a Jew. All of these, look, these people who claim they are Jews are Sabbateans. It will surprise you who they really are. And by the way, if Kerry had won, you'd still be going to Iraq and nothing would have changed, nothing. He would have done whatever the CFR told him to do.
Yeah, I'm certain you're right about that. So this is very fascinating about the Sabbateans. Is there any way to identify these people as such?
Oh, it's a marvelous conspiracy. But there have been enormous stacks of Jewish literature identifying them, and it's all hidden. Look, my book was a miracle. It's a miracle that it got out and sold so well, but part of the miracle was me. And part of the miracle is the book was getting so much publicity that I had a member of the Knesset, truly a moron, and his name, believe it or not, is Ophir Penis. He's got to live with that name. That's not my fault. He banned the book from the Knesset. From the podium of the Knesset, he ordered all booksellers in the country not to sell my book. And frankly, I could not wish for any finer piece of publicity for that book. I cannot tell you how grateful I am to this person for banning my book, because the next week it was at the top of the bestseller charts. I'm in a long list of people. If you want to look for great books, you look for Perfidy by Ben Hecht, which, by the way, is the classic of how the Jewish agency, led by Chaim Weizmann, deliberately and purposely murdered 800,000 Jews trapped in Hungary. And that's the classic book. Ben Hecht was a great screenwriter. He wrote The Front Page. He's very well acknowledged as a great writer. He wrote the book on how Rudolf Kastner was the emissary, who was the emissary of the Jewish agency, working directly for Chaim Weizmann, went to Hungary and became fast friends with Adolf Eichmann, and they saved 3,000 of his family and fellow Sabbateans and deliberately sent the rest to the gas chambers. Now, another rabbi, Rabbi Yoel Brand, he got the deal. The Germans through the back door got to him and said, if you give us 700 trucks, now, non-military trucks, apparently Eichmann wanted to get his loot out of the country. For 700 trucks, you could have all 800,000 Jews. 700 crummy trucks. General Motors makes that in half an hour. But the Jewish agency arrested Rabbi Brandt in Aleppo, Syria. He was arrested by Moshe Sharet, the second prime minister of Israel, and the deal was never known until, of course, Rabbi Brand wrote his book and it was covered up. You have to look at the transfer agreement by Edwin Black, also a very, very well-known and respected writer, did write for the Chicago Tribune when he wrote that book. You have to go through the vast amounts of literature out there and to see the real story. And I didn't just do that. I didn't just go out. I actually met the people. I met the people who know how Rudolf Kastner was killed. The person I met was, his name was Cohen. Yoel Cohen or Yitzhak Cohen, whatever. I met him in Tel Aviv. He said, I've been holding this secret for the longest time. I ran the laboratory at Hadassah Hospital in Tel Aviv. The killers came in. One was outside being a guard. The other put his knee down on Kastner's stomach where he had stitches, both the stitches, and the man drowned to death in his own blood. I went out and met the people who actually knew the real Israeli history, and I wrote these books, and these books are very good. And I suggest you go to lulu.com. You know what? I'm going to do something really brave. May I do something really brave?
I guess so.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes,
go ahead.
By all means.
Oh, boy, are you far away?
Oh, there I am. Sorry.
I'm gonna leave my cell number. It's not just the books. I have a DVD called The Vatican's New Crusade for Jerusalem. I have a bunch of DVDs, actually. My number is 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. Call me just to order, please. Not a social call. And I'll give you my email address as well. It's Chamish, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, at netvision, N-E-T-V-I-S-I-O-N dot net, N-E-T dot I-L. That's Chamish at netvision.net.il. I'll send you the books that I have if you want them. These arguments, by the way, are thoroughly, thoroughly justified and verified. And it's actually very scholarly work. And no one ever sued me in Israel because I was wrong. And no one ever will, including the murderer of Shimon Peres, who is now president of the country, or the mafioso Ehud Olmert, who I exposed in a book called The Fall of Israel way back in 1990 as simply a money-grubbing crook, or Ehud Barak, the defense minister, who deliberately and purposely, in order to sabotage the war I fought in, the Lebanon War of 1982, he sent, while the division commander, Yanush Ben-Gal, was on a jeep patrol, he picked up the radio, and he deliberately sent a religious armored unit into a Syrian ambush, resulting in 23 Israelis dead and three captured. He's a murderer. Our defense minister is a murderer. And by the way, I'm just skimming the surface here.
Barry, I've got to break here just a second and say that this is KATNLP 106.9 Salida. This is Truth Quest with Melody, and I've got Barry Chamish as a special guest and a co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom. Go ahead, Barry.
Barry, if I could slip in a question here.
Sure.
A lot of us have done quite a bit of research in the 911 truth movement, and it seems to be becoming quite clear to many of us anyway that 911 was an inside job to trigger this war on terrorism, which was a grab for world resources and imposition of a police state here, et cetera. And so then the question becomes is, if we look at the principals involved, such as Dick Cheney, George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, General Myers, is there any way to, Rudy Giuliani, et cetera, et cetera, is there any way to determine if some of these individuals would also be in this elite club of Zabataean?
Well, Giuliani, of course, became a British knight, you know, right after 9/11, the Queen awards him a knighthood. That raised my suspicions, but the real suspicions were raised, what was it, July 6th of 2004 when London was all shut up by Muslim terrorists. Giuliani was in town along with Benjamin Netanyahu. But again, this is all circumstantial. I've got the real stuff, and as a I'll do it. This is your forte, and I've actually done work. I was invited to speak at the fifth anniversary of September 11th at the Alternative September 11th conference. By the way, I'm on the internet speaking at that conference. Just look up, go to Google, just write YouTube, and then Chamish, and you'll see me there. I gave, a good speech. I have two, I'm the discoverer of one major 9/11, dilemma. That's putting it mildly. And I also discovered a connection with Ehud Olmert and the whole 9/11. Let's start with Olmert. Ehud Olmert is being investigated in Israel at this very moment because he tried to sell a bank to two people, both of them vicious. One is a member of the CFR. He was behind the murder of Utah Congressman Wayne Owens. His name is Daniel Abraham. Okay, that's number one. His partner, when Ehud Olmert was finance minister, he used his influence so these people could buy the third largest bank in Israel. And, boy, I have so much to say about that. Let me stop right here and just say something. When you have a Holocaust, bank accounts, if you own the banks where the dead people banked, you'll never have to return their money ever again. Another member of the Council on Foreign Relations is Edgar Bronfman. Really a nasty. The Bronfman family are nasty Sabbateans. Nasty. And their children, of course, are Catholics. And Edgar Bronfman is a Scientologist. I mean, these are classic Sabbateans. But it was about 4 years ago he won a judgment against the Swiss banks. He got $6.5 billion of Holocaust victims' bank accounts put into his back pockets. He won supposedly a major battle for the survivors of the Holocaust. He recovered their money, except do you know how much money he's given out to the survivors and their families? Want to take a guess?
I have no idea.
Right, nothing. $6.5 billion in his back pockets. And that is Edgar Bronfman. Now, another bank was sold. The largest bank in Israel is called Bank Discount. It was sold just before Israel has its own Holocaust to Edgar's son, Matt Bronfman. And believe me, when you're dead, your family is dead, you get to keep their money. And that's exactly what his father did. He's keeping the money of the dead Holocaust victims for himself. And $6.5 billion, there are countries in this world that don't earn it in 10 years. And it's all his. You have to understand who's ruining Israel. These are major crooks. But let's go backwards again to Ehud Olmert to 9/11. Daniel Abraham, Council on Foreign Relations. Okay? Never forget that. These people are all CFR members. Everyone involved in the downfall of Israel. The good guys, the bad guys, the in-between guys, it doesn't matter. The minor people like Zinni and Burns, the major people like Rice and Powell and Cheney and Brzezinski and Kissinger, they're all CFR. And they all want Israel to go. And this is a policy of the CFR. And again, I have an email list. Melody, did you get my latest Now the End is Near?
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did. You're on my list, so you had to have.
Oh, you mean, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking. Yes, I did get it.
Thank you. Okay. You will note that I have a great deal of notes. But I begin the note with George Bush, who announced that the intention of his administration was to force Israel into the 1949 armistice lines. He actually did this at a press conference. Just before Shimon Peres makes his first diplomatic trip as president of Israel to see the Pope. And by the way, Peres and the Pope go back a long time. Boy, did they go back a long time. But nonetheless, there's a diplomatic meeting between the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and Bush. Number one, who says he's the leader of the Palestinian Authority? He lost the last elections. He is the leader of nothing. Nothing. But these people are living in their own delusions, in their own world, and they're making leaders, even when their leaders lose, they make sure they don't go away. They leave the little meeting, the little tete-a-tete between Bush and Abbas, and Bush announces that the goal of his administration is to push Israel to its 1949 armistice lines. Folks, next time I write, I'm going to produce a map, and you'll see Israel in 1949. that country won't last one day with those borders. And I ended my article with a quote from Henry Kissinger. By the way, I mentioned Rabbi Antelman and the book he wrote to eliminate the opiate about the Sabbateans, in which he exposes him, not just exposes him, he excommunicated him from Judaism using his rabbinical court. Rabbi Marvin Antelman in 1974 excommunicated Henry Kissinger for his deliberate attempt to destroy Israel in the Yom Kippur War. He cut a deal with another Israeli traitor, really a garbage human being named Moshe Dayan. Kissinger and Dayan cut a deal with Dayan, who was then a defense minister, would let the Arabs have free reign over Israel for 24 hours. There would be no preemptive strike. 2,700 Israelis were killed in the first 3 days of the war. It was murdered by Dayan. 10,000 wounded, and in war, being wounded is not having a little boo-boo on your elbow. Yeah, you lose an eye, you're castrated, you're paralyzed. This is Moshe Dayan, way up there in the list of garbage that have run Israel, way up there.
I just should add one thing, Barry, and that is that there's a lot of literature more and more now showing that the Council on Foreign Relations has always also had the goal of destroying the sovereignty of the United States.
Well, look.
And moving us toward this one world government, this new world order, has been their goal from the beginning when they were founded in 1921.
No question about that. I mean, they destroyed Rhodesia. That was Kissinger, and what was his British counterpart, Lord
Cecil Rhodes?
No, we're not going back to 1905. We're going back to 1974 when they destroyed Rhodesia. Carrington. That was his name, Carrington. They destroyed Rwanda. It was Carrington and Kissinger. In Rwanda, next day the president of Rwanda is blown out of the sky in an airplane and the civil war breaks out and they use Israeli weapons. The Tutus kill the Tutus and Hutsis. Oh, forget it. This is not my field. I just happen to know this. They destroyed South Africa. Remember, there were alternatives. You didn't have, nothing is black and white. Okay, South Africa could have found some territory to be a sovereign white territory. They didn't have to turn over the whole place to whatever his name is. I don't even care. And not Bishop Tutu.
Mandela.
Yeah, that's the one. I try and blank all these CFR victories from my head. The fact is, everything becomes black and white. The same with Israel. It was never, ever an issue of land for peace. Who says it had to be land for peace? But once you instill that in people's heads and you get them to think there's only one solution, Israel's got to give up its land for peace, that's the way they'll think. That's how they destroyed South Africa. That's how they destroyed Rhodesia. And that's how they're going to destroy Israel. They're using the same techniques. And by the way, I have more than a few friends of mine from South Africa and Israel who are really contemplating suicide because they're watching, they moved from South Africa thinking they had some security in Israel, and they're watching the same thing taking place, and they don't know what to do anymore. They're tired of moving. Boy, well, have we drifted from the original...
it's very fine. If we could drift back to an earlier discussion here.
Daniel Abraham and Frank Lowy. Frank Lowy is the other person that Olbert tried to arrange the sale of Bank Lumitu. He owns the real estate of the World Trade Center, the shopping concourse. He owned the ground floor, 450... square feet of shopping concourse was Frank Lowy's. And boy, did he collect on the insurance policy. That is a name people tend to forget. They remember Larry Silverstein. They forget that Silverstein handed the concourse to Frank Lowy and that he is now involved in a major scandal in Israel where the prime minister tried to buy him a bank. But this isn't the end. If it was the end, I would say it's a coincidence. But there's something worse. There were two accountants for the Likud Party in the 1980s. They were Ehud Olmert and they were Menachem Atzmon. Both were caught with tremendous embezzlement, huge, giant embezzlement, dirty, dirty, dirty. But Olmert didn't go to prison, even though he was charged. But Menachem Atzmon did go to prison for 3.5 years. Now, when he must have done some people a mighty big favor, because when he got out of prison, he was made chairman of the board. Not a salesperson, not anything but chairman of the board. I mean, he's at the top of the very company, the very security company, who on 9/11 were guarding Logan and Newark airports. Menachem Atzmon, Ehud Olmert's partner, as accountant for the Likud in the late 1980s, was the one who, whatever was on those airplanes, whoever came off those airplanes, whatever happened to those airplanes, he and he alone knew. He was the one who was responsible for the security of the airports where 9/11 took place. Where the planes took off from, it was Logan in Boston and Newark, outside New York. Frank and Menachem Atzmon, Ehud Olmert's partner in the Likud Party, co-accountant, was the CEO of the company responsible for the security of those two airports. Now, that's true. And when you have two, you have to just say, I mean, this guy, number one, knew about 9/11, or number two, was in a circle of mafioso, a big, big circle of his ties are to the biggest slime balls on the face of the earth, and they were responsible in some way. I assure you, Menachem Atzmon, in some way, was responsible for 9/11. And Frank Lowy must have known those buildings were coming down, or he would never, ever, 6 weeks before, have signed an insurance policy against terrorism that made him a very rich man when those buildings went down. Both are intimately tied to Ehud Olmert. Did you know this?
No, that's good information. I appreciate that.
Oh, I think it's pretty good information, yeah, but it gets worse.
Was there any relation with Greenberg, Maurice Greenberg?
Pardon me?
Was there any relation there on the insurance with Maurice Greenberg?
Who's Maurice Greenberg?
Well, he was the CEO of the insurance company that paid off.
I have no idea. AIG. I never even heard of the guy.
Okay.
All I know, the insurance company paid double because there were two buildings, and that's about all I know. But I will go into things I actually do know. And the next issue is a big one. And I'm responsible for really changing a lot of people's views on one issue. Well, one, I had to step outside to light a cigarette. I can't smoke inside the house. All right. The issue and the reason why I was invited to this 9/11 conference, and I have given numerous interviews on this little issue, and it makes perfect sense if you follow me. At 5:20 in the afternoon of November 11th, Larry Silverstein, who is the owner of the World Trade Center, which included more buildings than the towers, decided, according to a PBS interview, that he had to pull Building 7. In case you didn't know, those are his exact words. And Building 7 went down in a controlled collapse. Straight down. Nothing sideways. By the way, in a city like New York, you don't just pull a building. You don't do that. There was a little fire in the building that did not endanger it. And by the way, I'd like to know how it even started on fire. I think that fire was a little bit of arson so they can have an excuse to pull the building. But neither here nor there, in the shadow of the smoldering towers, at 5:20 in the afternoon, Building 7 went down in a perfectly controlled collapse. All right? straightforward. Now we ask the big question. How the hell did Larry Silverstein know his building was filled with explosives? It would take weeks to survey a building 47 stories tall and put the explosives in the bearing joints where the building would collapse straight down. This is a complicated issue. But at 5:20 in the afternoon, he decided to pull Building 7. Now, everyone knows that happened. And Silverstein went on TV and admitted that he gave the order. But here's the big issue. Why did it happen? Now, the 9/11 researchers, some good, some amateurs, but nonetheless, they came up with these hackneyed, horrible reasons that this company was in there, and this company, where there was the FBI in there, and there was the Security Commission in there, and for that they pulled the building. Here's what really happened. The building would have fallen with another plane, just like the first two towers, just like it was supposed to, except Flight 93 didn't arrive. There was a major glitch in 9/11. Now, I assume that it was remote-controlled planes where they shut off the computers and they sent the planes into buildings, but somewhere along the line with Flight 93, the crew overcame the remote control. And don't believe this ridiculous story that of the wrestling team phoning their loved ones by cell phones and saying, "Let's roll, boys." That was the worst script I have ever in my life seen for what must have happened. The crew must have just simply found a way out. And the plane, I think it was shot down. There's certainly enough research. I've seen the pictures. That plane's nose was so far away from its tail that it had to have been shot in midair. But the point of the matter is that plane never arrived in New York to fill Building 7. So Silverstein was left with a building full of explosives. And the last thing he needed with the police snooping around everywhere was for them to find the explosives inside the building. So he brought the building down. That's what happened. And I'll tell you something, that evidence alone, in any court of law, Silverstein would have a heck of a problem explaining why he fell that building. I think in an honest court of law with an honest jury, he would be found guilty of knowing there were explosives in that building. At a minimum, he might have to give back to $7 billion.
Yeah, it's getting pretty hard to argue with a confession on PBS.
It's pretty hard to argue why. Look, again, there's only one reason why that building went down. That building went down because the plane didn't bring it down. That's the only plausible reason. And now, lo and behold, you hear this all over the place. People are now opening their mouths and saying that Building 7 was supposed to be brought down by Flight 93, but Flight 93 didn't arrive. Folks, I was the first one who came up with that simple conclusion. And frankly, I was shocked that there was no one before me. When I made that conclusion, it was from day one of 9/11. Day one, I said, nobody brings down another building unless there's a darn good reason. And the darn good reason was the plane didn't arrive. Larry's plane didn't arrive. And that's why he brought down the building so the explosives wouldn't be found. That simple. And that's my little contribution to 9/11.
Okay, well, Barry, to move into what's happening now with the saber rattling of our government talking about a strike against Iran, it's not on the radar screen over here that there is a goal or a plan to destroy Israel at all. Could you put that?
It's certainly known in Israel.
Yeah, okay, it's known in Israel perhaps, but here what it looks like is that this government has preemptively invaded Afghanistan as well as Iraq, and now, as per the script of the neocons in their project for a new American century, they are contemplating an invasion. They're making the moves towards an invasion of Iran, and then perhaps in the future. So it would appear from from this side of the ocean that they're just carrying out a plan or a script that was written for them by the Project for a New American Century, which is global domination of the world's resources. Nowhere in that script is there anything written about. So I don't understand why the.
Let me explain my personal knowledge and how I get information and look. The atrocity in Israel was the Oslo so-called peace accord, but that brought down Israel. That was the end of Israel. Previous to that, Israel was a proud nation with proud citizens holding on to its own against a hostile world, but its children were proud to serve in the army. No one objected to guarding settlements. That's a bunch of hooey produced by CNN. No one objected to it. I served in that army for 13 years. I never saw any objection. Peace Now can't get 10 people out to their protest, but they're worth $100 billion from the European governments to do protests, which no one shows up to. You've got to understand that black is white and left is right and day is night. Everything, all your reality has been manipulated, and nothing is as it seems to be. Now, after the Oslo Accord was signed, it was the Declaration of Principles was in September of 93. I was at a Hanukkah party December of 93. And, well, I've got friends throughout the political spectrum of Israel. It was at the home of Lenny Wolf, a good friend of mine at the time. I haven't seen him in a while, but he's a good guy. And he says to me, and by the way, I was co-editor of what was really a very small newsletter. This was pre-internet. Internet killed my newsletter, Inside Israel. But my co-partner was Joel Bainerman. Bainerman, by the way, wrote a book, the very first expose of the Bush family, exposing them for everything they were. And Joel suffered. And by the way, they can give people cancer. And I've written about this in Joel's case, what happened in Washington. He was given a tie by a so-called fan. Within minutes, his neck swelled up. He phoned his wife, says, I'm coming home, I can't breathe anymore. Within 4 months, his neck was filled with cancer. They do kill you through disease. And Joel was a witness to that. But Joel wrote Crimes of the President, the first expose of the Bush family. And I wrote a book that same year. And by the way, it was called The Fall of Israel. It was published in Edinburgh, Scotland. It was the lead review of The Economist, the first review, a whole page on my little book. It was throughout the British media, major reviews, most of them quite decent. The Economist review was quite decent. So we were kind of hot way back then. In 93, he had a book that was selling well. I had a book that was reviewed well. So my friend Lenny says, why don't you, do you want me to run Pudok? Now, there were two Israelis who negotiated the Oslo Accord. There were Yair Hirschfeld and Ron Pudok. Now, of Yair Hirschfeld, he was, and by the way, the information I got, he was from Vienna. He was the Sabbatean Jewish leader of Austria, Bruno Kreisky. He was his personal aide. Kreisky was, look, you've got a country with 8,000 Jews. How does a Jew become president of the country? And this is a whole different story. I got information from people who knew Yair Hirschfeld. He was a nut. This man was in and out of mental institutions. His whole youth was spent in mental institutions. People would write me and said, do you know who wrote Oslo up? The guy's a madman. That was Yair Hirschfeld, okay? He was a spy sent from the Socialist International Shimon Peres' organization to wreck Israel, ended up a professor at Tel Aviv University, and his buddy was Ron Pudok, the other writer of Oslo. Okay? Now, Pudok didn't have the kind of insane background of Yair Hirschfeld, but nonetheless, he was stupid as hell. So God, he was really, really stupid. Now, me and Joel met him at a coffee house in Tel Aviv. We interviewed him for about 2 hours in December of 1993. And that is really early in this game. And I want to tell you, this is inside information, the best inside information. The actual writer of the Oslo Court from the Israeli side is our interviewee. Now, he told us many, many things that I'm not going to... You have to get my books, folks. It's that simple. But Pundak said many things, but one stands out. For instance, he told us Shimon Peres had nothing to do with Oslo, that Rabin hid it from him. He didn't use the word traitor. I am. It was Yossi Beilin. He's this homosexual... well, he was called Shimon Peres' poodle, but in this case he was working against Peres and working with Rabin. Rabin was given the order by George Bush Sr. He later admitted to the New York Times, to William Sapphire, he was ordered by George Bush that he was going to negotiate with the PLO and he was going to prepare his country for painful sacrifices. The painful sacrifice occurred in November of 1992 when Yair Hirschfeld and Ron Pudak went to London, met Mahmoud Abbas in a London hotel, and who was waiting in the lobby by a grand coincidence? None other than Yossi Beilin, if you could believe this asinine story that he tried selling to the Israeli people. And I guess the Israeli people really are extremely stupid because they seem to have believed it and didn't question it. I interviewed Ron Pudak. Shimon Peres had nothing to do with Oslo. We found that out through various ways. But here is the big story. Right at the end of the interview, and by the way, he's bragging. He is actually bragging to us. He thinks that we view him as a hero. He doesn't hear the disdain in our voices. He's bragging and bragging. He says, you know what my boss, his boss is Yossi Beilin, by the way. He says, you know, my boss doesn't believe in borders. And Joel knew what he was talking about. I didn't. I said, what does that mean? He says, borders cause war. He said, at the end of Oslo, Israel will not have borders. I said, what do you mean? I was stunned. I said, what do you mean? Without borders, there is no Israel. And he says, something better is going to replace it. He said, we're all going to lose our borders. The whole Middle East is going to be a giant trading block. And Israel will meld into the trading block. We're all going to be one happy trading block, he said, with no more wars. And he says that Israel will become a conduit for trucks from Morocco getting to Iran, and we'll provide the motels and the gas stations, and we'll love our Arab neighbors, and they'll become our friends. I was shocked. And from that moment on, I have been saying it loudly and clearly. People, the people who formulated the so-called Oslo Peace Accord, they're nuts. These people are absolutely madmen. Israel is going to be destroyed by them. You don't understand, people. They are going to destroy Israel, beginning with Gaza, Judea, and Samaria, but they are going to destroy Israel. And, of course, the first thing they did was bring in 50,000 PLO troops, and we provided them with their weapons. That was Shimon Peres already. And if you don't think that Peres knew, didn't understand that those weapons would be used to kill settlers, you're very, very wrong. And here's how we know exactly what he knew. Because in 1996, before he was going to leave power, I'll tell you about how Benjamin Netanyahu, CFR stooge, blackmailed Peres to lose the election because Peres murdered Rabin and they found the documents. And I'll tell you how I found out about that. But more to the point, Paris phones up John Deutsch, head of the CIA, CFR, by the way. Get your CFR list out. And George Tenet, the Middle East expert of the CIA, of the CFR, get your CFR list out. And he says the PLO are not killing settlers well enough. They need training. Paris sent the first 40 PLO so-called policemen to Virginia, where they were trained in the latest, with the latest equipment. They were trained in drive-by shootings, how to escape. They were made into excellent terrorists by the CIA. Now, in two articles previously, which I sent to Melody, finally the PLO admit that without the American training, they would not have been in the position to defeat Israel. It was with CIA, CFR training that the PLO became a force Israel will soon lose to. It was done through Shimon Peres, now president of Israel, who is conniving the end of Israel. And on purpose, by the way.
Yeah, and of course we see the same thing happening here with our president negotiating in secret with the presidents of Canada and Mexico to...
I see your point there. Okay.
And what they're talking about is setting up trading blocks around the world, which would dissolve the borders of the countries, the 190 states that we have now, and dissolve them into about 10 trading blocks.
From that point, I see your point. The problem with it is you're not going to get... You're not going to get rocketed from Mexico, is what I was about to say. But give it enough time, who knows?
Well, I think from our point of view, what this means is that this means that our leaders can tear up the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which has made living in America a pretty good deal. And, of course, it can move us back towards serfdom and a feudalistic society, which I think is what our leaders have in mind for us.
Well, doesn't that sound like fun to be a farmer on some feudal estate?
No, of course not. That sounds pretty hideous. And so I think it's something we all need to be informed about. I just think that maybe the same kind of planning is going on here, except for, as you point out, it's much, much more volatile and dangerous situation in Israel.
Well, I'm going to tell you one other little story that will make things very clear to you. Because, again, it's not a personal story. This was the story of how all of Israel knew that Peres was a spy for the Vatican and did nothing about it. Now, the story begins with a newspaper article in February of 1994. When Mark Halter, a close friend of Peres, he is described as a French intellectual, says that he delivered last May a letter from Paris to the Pope, and he describes the letter. Now, here is the background. Paris was kept out of the Oslo Accords. Now, this is what Quindux told us, that only five people knew about the Oslo Accords until April of 93, and they were Rabin, Balin, Quindux, Hirschfeld, and someone named Ori Sevier, who I hope someday hangs from the highest oak tree in the land, but it's just a fantasy. He'll escape too, but I hope so. Paris finds out about it in April of 93. He doesn't take it seriously for about a week. Then he finds out it's the only game in town, so he fights back his way. He's going to bring the Vatican into this game. And by the way, look at the Vatican Treaty of 1993, and the Declaration of Principles, Oslo and the Vatican Treaty, which supposedly recognizes Israel, even though it doesn't in any way recognize Israel, they are the same treaty. Oslo and the Vatican Treaty of Paris and Balin are the exact same treaty. Now, Paris, in the letter, according to Mark Halter, promises the Pope all of East Jerusalem. He promises the Pope that the Vatican will gain hegemony over all the holy places of the old city of Jerusalem, including the Western Wall, I add. He says the United Nations will police this new city, and you will get your capital back. I will finally get the Vatican its capital back. And super duper fine, except that was only one interview. It gets worse. The magazine La Stampa, a major Italian magazine, confirms the letter shortly afterwards, and then adds something very, very important, that all of Jerusalem is going to be, well, a duty-free shop. Really, that the Vatican would get an enclave all the way to Atarot Airport. People could arrive without passports. It would be the world's first duty-free shop. They've made Jerusalem the capital of the Vatican, and any crook in the world can arrive there without a passport. That's what it comes down to. Now, this is fine, Danny. Now we've got two reports, but here's where things became extremely serious for Paris. And in any normal circumstances, he would have had to have resigned. But we're talking about Israel, where the people are idiots, so he doesn't. A year later, it was February of 1995, when Arut Sheva, which is the radio station, and well, now it is. Now it's just a crummy website of the settlers. But nonetheless, back then its influence was enormous. It received a leak from, well, the foreign ministry, the embassy in Rome to the foreign ministry in Jerusalem, run by Paris, of course. He was foreign minister, outlining the transfer of power to the Vatican. That all sovereignty and hegemony of the old city, including the Western Wall and the Temple Mount, are transferred to the Vatican. And Arut Sheva puts it on their website. The next day, Haaretz is like sort of like the New York Times, but a lot worse. It's the Israeli newspaper of the far left. We've just lost their bearings completely. But nonetheless, they put it on the front page of their weekend edition. That's Friday in Israel. The whole country now sees that Paris is going to transfer Jerusalem to the Vatican. Now, that sounds weird. It didn't sound weird to me. But nonetheless, I took special care to follow this story. Now, every year at Passover, Paris used to hobnob with major rabbis at their tables and do serious politicking. That year, all the rabbis canceled him. They all canceled him, every one of them. Well, come on, I mean, the guy's handing over the capital of Israel to the Vatican. You're not going to be welcome at their tables. Okay? So he's got to come up with an explanation. And he does. Through his spokesman, the foreign ministry, he admits, as foreign minister, that yes, the cable was authentic. The cable that appeared on the front page of Haaretz. However, someone had whited out the text, the word not. So the real cable read, Israel will not be handing the Vatican hegemony over the old city. Now that's a real urgent cable, let me tell you. There is a cable they must have been waiting for days on end. Israel is not going to hand over hegemony. And you know, the stupidity of the Israeli rabbis, and I'll talk about this briefly, where they have lost the loyalty of their students, and I'm getting letters from their parents saying, what are we going to do? My son makes fun of his rabbis. Something new has happened in Israel, but that's not the point. The absolute naivety and stupidity of the rabbis is they re-invited Paris to their tables. All of Israel caught Paris in a lie. All of Israel knew he offered the Vatican Jerusalem, their capital, and nothing was done about it. Nothing. He's not after murdering Rabin Sharon. Well, of course, he murdered Rehavam Ze'evi, the tourism minister. The list is long and ugly of how many murders Parrish has got his fingers on. We haven't even begun to talk about what was done to the Spire Dean in the early 1950s, where he's got a lot more murders than I'm talking about tonight. The point of the matter is the Israeli people caught him red-handed and let him go on until he finally does destroy the country. Because I guess when the Jews, when push comes to shove, the Sabbateans have one major advantage over the Jews. The Jews are an immensely, immensely dense and stupid people, and they will walk into another Holocaust coming up. Are we there?
Yes, we are.
Yes. I'm going to do the plug again. My website is barrychamish.com. That's BarryChamish.com. To get my books, the story, by the way, of Paris, well, you know, go to lulu.com. Get my book, Save Israel, for that one. LULU.com, you'll see a spot that says search. You look my name up, Chamish, and you'll see all the books. Well, very inexpensive. And again, I have the DVD, The Vatican's New Crusade Against Jerusalem, where I do this for 2 hours. My email is chamish@netvision.net.il, and I'll do a major favor, but only for ordering. The number is 904-501-7605, 904-501-7605. If you feel like ordering the DVD, I'll send it to you, and it won't cost you much.
Well, I certainly appreciate all this, you know, that you've been giving us on this information, because there's a lot that I'm sure a lot of people aren't aware of on what's, you know, going on in the world with Israel.
Well, as what I'm finding out in America is the Jews know nothing, and the same Jews who let the Europeans die because the Sabbateans had completely taken over the FDR's administration. The worst of them was so-called Rabbi Stuart Weiss, head of the Reform, who made sure not one Jew was saved in Europe. And he did this on purpose. The good Zionists, again, Jabotinsky's boys, including Hillel Cook. Well, it was Peter Cook who went on. All right, Peter Cook, let's leave it at that now. More just great literature about how the American Jews sold us Jews of Europe without understanding just how bad these labor Zionists really were. The worst crime against the Jewish people in all its history was the foundation of labor Zionism. It's been nothing but a disaster, and if we don't watch out, you're going to see 5.5 more million Jews die in Israel. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next year, but they're being set up right now.
Now, when you say Israel is being set up, you think this would be in the context of a regional war that the United States...
I already explained that. I did the whole missile war at the beginning of the show.
Well, what's going to trigger that?
Anything, any spark, any excuse. You don't have to worry about a trigger. When the Arabs feel like a trigger is happening, they'll start a war, and Israel will not be able to survive this war. And forget the Samson option. If it wasn't even suggested last year, if it wasn't suggested against Iraq way back in 91 when chemical, and this is not known, but the Iraqis used gas against Israel, if Israel wasn't prepared to at least drop a bomb in the middle of an empty desert to show her intentions, Israel's not going to drop to save herself now. The old Israel kept the Middle East in order with that threat. The old Israel would never have allowed Egypt to turn the Sinai Desert into a shopping mall for Hamas to smuggle. They're not smuggling. They're just picking it up, all the equipment necessary to bomb Israel into smithereens. Israel would have told the Egyptians, this keeps up. We'll bomb the Aswan Dam, and good luck when a 50-foot wave swallows all your people. You know, that was the old Israel. The new Israel, with its leadership, has determined that Israel will die. This is at the highest levels, that it's the commitment of the Israeli leadership to get rid of this Torah-loving state. Well, they will get rid of the Torah-loving state of Israel, and it's going to be happening really, really soon. Israel is finished.
Barry, do you want to give us a little bit of a hint of, the story behind how you got here this last time, and, with your stroke and...
What should I say? I had a stroke. It's finished. There's okay. Nothing there. That's not a good question. Okay. I described that, and then I'm not going to describe it anymore.
Okay.
I came to America. I had a stroke. It didn't finish me off, so then a car crash. I was lured to a Yom HaTzmaut. What kind of a party? Yom HaTzmaut is Independence Day party after I gave an evening of selling in Jerusalem. When I got there, a car at full speed, a rented car, went straight to my door. I was dead. I was dead in the hospital. They revived me 3 times. In the hospital, friends of mine just said, you're on the hit list right now. Just get out of this country. The fastest plane out of here. Just get out of here. You're not going to live much longer. You see what's been happening to you. I did see what was going to be happening to me. I flew to America where I had remarkably bad experiences at the beginning. I had 2 homos in a row supposedly inviting me to recuperate and get my life together. They had very, very rough intentions for me. But then came Messianic Christians who wanted me to convert and to tell the world that this woman had visions of the Torah, and that was very difficult. Finally, after a long, long time, a year, I met a woman, and she's a lovely woman. We have a very loving marriage, and I'm far more settled than I was before. But she wants to move to Israel someday, and she's converting to Judaism, and she's learning Hebrew, and she's getting good at it. And she can read better than I could read at the same stage, and that's the story.
And in between, you also had a trip to Canada there?
Yeah, I stayed with my cousin in Vancouver. Canada is a very problematic place simply because a person with new ideas, there's really no place for you there. It's a country that has a very strict establishment. What's your favorite Canadian movie?
I know I've seen a number of them, but I'll have to say that it's been 20 years ago.
One. You have not seen a number of them.
I have. I really have. But it was 20 years ago.
Name me a Canadian invention.
That I couldn't tell you.
There aren't any. And that's the problem with Canada. I left Canada because of that. Initially, and when I went back there, nothing had changed. It's the same sort of country. But unfortunately, they have a health plan, which America doesn't. And I don't know how to get one here. And unless I do, I'm going to die in the streets with my accordion and my monkey beside me, because there's no health protection in this country. That's the only good thing about Canada, is for $50 a month, you have full health coverage.
That would be nice here, that's for sure.
Well, yes, but other than that, America at least is open to my ideas, and Canada is not open to new ideas. It's not that kind of a country.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that you've got met a nice lady, and things are starting to work out for you.
Yeah, it's settling. You have to settle these things. You have to iron out things. And it takes time, but we're getting there.
Well, I really appreciate Dr. Carlstrom and Barry for a great program and giving us insight into areas of the world that, like I said, a number of us are somewhat unfamiliar. And thank you very much, Barry, for...
Okay, thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Barry, for joining us. It's been very informative. We appreciate it.
I barely scratched the surface. Go get the books on lulu.com. And Melody, I know you have books, so air them.
Okay, I'll do so.
Okay, we'll be in touch soon.
Okay, thanks so much.